society which is acquisitive rather than a society which is sensitive. All of this fits a pattern, and it's not a pleasant one. We are at the end of our day. This is Bill O'Brien, and you've been listening to the Head On Radio Network. I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Please be safe. We'll be back together again on Monday. This is Bill O'Brien. Have a great weekend.
Door holding areas for protesters. According to Dave Verhasselt, spokesman for Ramsey County Manager David Twa, the St. Paul police generally have jurisdiction over arrest and the sheriff over jailing once arrests are made. But yes, there's been a request for between $3 and $4 million, and they're going to have these holding areas. That ought to be really nice. In 2004, six protesters were arrested at the Democratic National Convention in Boston, while approximately 10,000 were arrested during the RNC in New York City, according to sources close to the budget process. The St. Paul Police Department has already begun working with groups interested in expressing peaceful opposition to the RNC, and Fletcher's request appears on its surface to conflict with that process. Home of the muzzled, land of the jailed. Boy, they're getting ready a couple years ahead of time for what they expect to be mass arrest. Now, why would anybody be protesting at a Republican National Convention? Do these conventions even mean anything anymore? They really don't to me. They just serve as showcases for a lot of people to get up and give a speech. Our candidates have been chosen a long time before that. I do want to mention that tomorrow we're going to have Lieutenant Eric Schein. And he's going to be our guest tomorrow. I'm looking to see here. The Bush administration has been after this guy for a long, long time. And he's going to be here to tell us about the inner workings of our government and U.S. corporations and federal contractors and so forth. He's been hounded half to death by the Bush administration. I had a nice press release here, and I don't know what happened to it. But he's got a case pending in front of the federal court. And he will be our guest tomorrow in the first hour of the program. So do keep that in mind. We've had a good week for people to have on the show today. I really enjoyed Victor Gold a lot. Mikey Weinstein yesterday. Kinds of people that I could talk to quite a lot, and evidently from the email we got, you enjoyed them very much as well. We're down to that point in the program. I'm sorry, we got a couple of phones ringing here, but we can't take your calls right now. We've only got about a minute left, and call's back tomorrow. Why do you wait till the last minute anyway, huh? Don't do that. We've enjoyed having all of you with us today here on the Guy James Show. We intentionally stayed away from the Virginia Tech story. We pretty much set our piece on that, and we join with everybody in mourning the loss of all those folks. Innocent life lost. It's a tragedy, and the folks are with us in our hearts and our prayers. And all the talking about it in the world, I guess, isn't going to change anything with it now. So be advised that those people are in our thoughts and our prayers, and will continue to be. And I hope the healing comes for them. That's a tough thing for a lot of young folks to see things like that happening to them, most certainly. Well, you've been listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. I want to thank you for being with us today, from all you listeners from all the different websites around the entire internet. Thanks so much for being with us today. Proud member of the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
This is the Quality News Network. Defense Secretary Robert Gates continued his trip to Iraq today. He met with top U.S. commanders again today. However, another planned stop, a tour of a joint U.S.-Iraqi security post, was abruptly canceled. A three-mile-long wall is being built in Baghdad to separate Sunni and Shiite neighborhoods. The U.S. military is constructing the 12-foot-high barrier in a northern part of the capital city. It is expected to be finished by the end of this month. Some Republican lawmakers are angry that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said yesterday that the Iraq War is lost and cannot be won through U.S. military force. Today is a day of mourning for the 32 victims of the Virginia Tech massacre on Monday. Memorial services honored the slain students and professors. Virginia Governor Tim Kaine promised, quote, there will be a brighter day. Next week, the board of directors of the World Bank will decide whether embattled chief Paul Wolfowitz will stay on as bank president. The charges of favoritism connected with the revelations that he helped a girlfriend obtain a high-paying job at the bank have led to increased calls for Wolfowitz to resign. Republican Representative Rick Renzi of Arizona, who is under investigation by the Justice Department for a land deal, has stepped down temporarily from the House Intelligence Committee. Polls indicate France's presidential election Sunday is too close to call. Campaigning wrapped up today. It is barred on Saturday, the day before the vote. The U.S. Embassy in Germany is boosting security in response to a heightened threat situation. An embassy official told Reuters that it is related to the threat of terrorism. The Johnson Space Center in Houston has been evacuated after reports that shots were fired there earlier today. A NASA spokesperson said a person with a weapon is inside. Billionaire Helen Robson Walton, the widow of Walmart founder Sam Walton, died last night of natural causes in her Arkansas home. She was 87 years old. In Littleton, Colorado, Columbine High School is closed today, as it is every April 20th, in commemoration of the students and teachers who were killed there in 1999. You are listening to the Quality News Network.
Here's good news about your money. Monterey County Bank has won the Bauer Financial 5-Star Superior Rating for financial strength and stability, making it one of the safest banks in Monterey County for your money. It's nice to know your money is in a safe place, but there are even more reasons to bank with Monterey County Bank. They now have 4 convenient locations in Carmel, Monterey, Carmel Valley, and Pacific Grove. And Monterey County Bank is the oldest locally owned bank, now celebrating its 30th anniversary serving you. Here's another important point. Local businesses have come to trust and rely on Monterey County Bank's position as the county's number one SBA small business lender. Safety, convenience, and local people you can trust. That's Monterey County Bank. Stop in at one of our 4 branches and find out why you can bank on us. Monterey County Bank. SBA Preferred Lender and Equal Housing Lender, Member FDIC.
The FDA has a theory that the pet food ingredients imported from China that were found to have an industrial chemical used in the manufacture of plastic may have been intentionally contaminated to boost their protein content. Former Quest Communications CEO Joe Nocio has been convicted of 19 counts of insider trading. He faces a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison and a $1 million fine on each count. The nation's largest radio station operator, Clear Channel Communications, will sell its 56 television stations. A private equity group will pay $1.2 billion for the stations. Computer maker Dell will allow its customers to choose whether they want the new Windows Vista or the older Microsoft operating system Windows XP on their PCs. The decision came after more than 10,000 visitors to a Dell website indicated they still wanted the XP option. Inventors in England have developed a way to get your caffeine in the shower. It's a peppermint-scented soap which contains the caffeine equivalent of 2 cups of coffee. The makers say that the stimulant is absorbed through the skin naturally. Light Sweet Crude is trading at $63.38 a barrel, and the third record close in a row this week for the Dow Jones, which ended the week up 153 points while the Nasdaq was up 21. There's always more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Yesterday, we talked about the stock market and its fall and the plight of the very rich, the CEOs and those that are earning in the top 1% of American incomes. Today, I want to talk about the other end of the spectrum, the very poor. Who are the people in poverty? Where do they come from? What makes them poor? Where do they live? What areas of the country are they in? Do they suffer from diseases? Are they on drugs? Are they homeless? There's a lot to talk about, and a lot of people don't want to focus on the very poor, and yet they are in many ways the backbone of our country. My guest today is Avis Jones DeWeaver. She's the Director of Poverty Education and Social Justice Programs for the Institute for Women's Policy Research, and she's going to help me answer these questions. Ms. Jones DeWeaver, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for having me.
The president today, Ms. Jones DeWeaver, is down in the Gulf Coast in Mississippi and in New Orleans to talk about still how we haven't come back after Katrina a year and a half later. Is this just a photo opportunity, or are the president's policies making a difference in the poor?
Unfortunately, I would characterize it as a photo op. When you look at where the rubber meets the road, this administration has been sorely lacking with regards to living up to the responsibility of providing an opportunity for people to be able to work their way up and out of poverty. It's particularly tragic event when you consider what's going on in the Gulf Coast, because after Katrina, President Bush made a trip down to New Orleans where he specifically said we have a duty to confront this poverty with bold action. But since then, he's submitted one budget after another that specifically seeks to cut billions of dollars away from programs specifically meant to address the poorest of America's poor, and hasn't really done anything to address their specific issues.
Let's talk about who the poor are. I mean, how do you define poverty in America? How many people are in poverty, and has it grown or decreased over recent years?
Well, the way we define poverty in America is a little controversial. We have several different thresholds depending upon the size of your family. So in 2005, for example, for a family of four, you're considered poor if you're making a little under $20,000 per year. For four people. That's for a family of four.
That's hard to feed a family of four with $20,000, I would
think. Of course. It's almost impossible. And then if you look at how many people are poor nationwide, it's roughly 37 million people who are poor.
But so that's more than 10% of America.
Yes. Definitely, and it's been growing since 2000. It's been growing every year since 2000, with the exception of 2005, where it finally leveled off. But perhaps even more disturbing, we've been seeing a huge growth in the number of people who live in dire poverty. That's the number of people who make less than half of the poverty line. So in that case, you would consider a family of four making only about $9,900 a year as being in dire poverty. And we found that that number of people is roughly around 16 million people. So we have a lot of people out there who are just barely making it.
Now, when you say a family of four, are these often one wage earner families or two? Is it often, is it a woman and three children, or is it a woman and a man and then two kids?
It could be either way. We defined it as either the specific number that I gave you was referring to a two-parent family with two children. But we also have numbers that refer to one mother and three children, and it's not really that much more. So we're talking about people who are barely making it by. If you look at
now, you said it's gone up since 2000. Now, of course, all our population goes up. America just hit the 300 million mark a few years ago. Is it growing as a percent?
They are just about everywhere where we are. They are America.
And how do they end up? How do people end up? One would be someone who's boss or something that makes them poor. And then the third example I was thinking of, as you mentioned, the border states, would be people who cross the border who were poor in Mexico or other countries and seek to do better in the United States. How am I with those categories, and are there others?
You're right on the mark there. I would say that there are some segments of the poor that one could argue have been poor intergenerationally, where there are families that have a long lineage of living in poverty. And oftentimes those are stuck in very persistent situations, urban poor, deep south poor, and just never been able to move their way out. then
tell you what, why don't we start with them and then we'll go on to the other groups.
Sure.
What explains this cycle of poverty? Is it bad education? Is it bad life choices? Bad government programs? What is it?
I think it's a lot of things. I think one of the reasons is an outgrowth of intergenerational lack of responsibility in terms of providing great access and equal access to a quality education in America. I think we need to really recognize the fact that we still do have in America two very separate, two very unequal schooling systems. And how can one expect a child to really be able to excel in school if one's parent is barely self-perpetuating, when it's very, very difficult to pull children out of situations where they can't come home and expect to get the report that the support that many families take for granted in terms of supplementing their children's educational experience.
There's so much to talk about, folks. This is a very broad topic, and I know you want to get your input in. If you have a question or a comment for Ms. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, please don't hesitate to call in. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON or 888-488-MARK. Either way, we're glad to hear from you. We'll be right back discussing poverty and all its implications. We'll be right back after this.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Obviously need to address the issue of the Saddam Hussein execution. Have seen the video that was taken on a cell phone, or have read about the circumstances surrounding the execution. It's pretty evident that the absolutely worst thing that could have happened with the carrying out of the sentence after the long trial of Saddam Hussein happened. And if we had sat down and made a list and said, all right, here's a list of six or seven different things that could happen, what would be the very, very worst thing that could happen, not only for us, for the United States, but for the world and for the Iraqis themselves? And it seems to me that if not first, then definitely second would have been what indeed did happen.
The Dr. Bill O'Brien Show, Tuesday to Thursday, noon to 2 Eastern, here on the Head On Radio Network.
Did you know the University of Nebraska is a leader in the landscape of computer science and business education? Our J.D. Edwards Honors Program combines business strategy with next-generation computer software. That's how you teach leaders for the 21st century. I'd call that thinking outside the box. There is no place like Nebraska. The University of Nebraska, Lincoln. Did you know the University of Nebraska is a virtual world leader in the field of distance education? And that they bring highly interactive learning right into the homes of students in all 93 Nebraska counties, all 50 states, and 135 countries around the world using the latest computer website technology? I guess the lesson here is, no matter where you live, there's no place like Nebraska. The University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
We'll be right back.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. The topic today is poverty. We're going to discuss really all the ins and outs. Who are the poor in America? What makes them that way? And how can we help break the cycle of poverty? My guest is Avis Jones DeWeaver. She's a PhD, has a doctorate. She's the director of poverty education and social justice programs for the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Ms. Jones DeWeaver, before the break, we were talking about the most persistent cases, maybe the most difficult cases, and that's people who it seems are in generations of poverty. Their parents were poor, their grandparents were poor, and it just seems to go generation after generation. Many people thought that welfare reform was supposed to be addressed to this group of people. What is going on with this hardcore poor people, if you will, and how can we break the back of this cycle?
You know, it's really quite difficult, and I'm glad you brought up this issue of welfare reform, because I think that ties into our seeing these startling numbers with regards to the rise in the number of people who are in dire poverty today. 10 years ago, when we passed welfare reform, we said that we are only going to give you 5 years of cash assistance out of your entire lifetime. So during this time that you're on welfare, we're going to make sure that we can push you into a job so that you can become self-sufficient. That was the goal of welfare reform. As it has played out, welfare reform, one could argue, was quite successful in getting people from welfare to work because roles have dropped by about 60%. The problem then becomes what types of jobs are people able to get. And what we found is that overall people have gotten very low-wage, insecure jobs that don't offer benefits, don't offer a lot in terms of stability. And so people have been cycling on and off of work and living on the fringes. And so that's why today I think we are finding a situation where there's a huge increase in the number of people who are living in dire poverty, many of whom are in fact working, but just not making enough to make ends meet and having to then rely on other forms of assistance like food stamps and Medicaid just to be able to piece together enough assistance to be able to get by.
Ms. Jones-Weaver, I wonder if you can give us some statistics. I'm curious to know what percentage of people in poverty and in dire poverty, as you've defined it, are actually working part-time or full-time, have a job.
It's been estimated that about half of those who are in poverty are working at least part of the time. Now, a lot of those who aren't working can't work. We have a number of people in America who are disabled or who have other problems that we might consider very persistent problems that make it difficult for them to hold down a job, such as substance abuse, such as some sort of mental illness, but maybe are having difficulty qualifying for Social Security or disability insurance, or maybe they're taking on the responsibility of taking care of a child or a parent who is disabled or has some sort of problem that's prohibiting them from being able to go out in the workforce themselves. So all of those, there are situations where, which I think we all would agree that it's legitimate for someone not to have a job. And then there are some people who, for some whatever reason, are not finding consistent employment. I think one of the problems that many economists point to is something referred to as spatial mismatch. And what they're talking about when they use that term is the fact that as we've seen jobs grow in the nation since the end of the manufacturing economy, we've seen that a lot of those jobs have taken place in areas that are away from where America's poorest of the poor live. So, for example, a lot of job growth happens in the suburbs and not in the inner city. And if you're poor already and you don't have any form of transportation, and public transportation isn't going to be very good, that oftentimes doesn't even go out to where a lot of these jobs are, then for all practical purposes, it just makes it very difficult for people to hold down jobs for any consistent amount of time.
Would that make a huge difference? I mean, if public transportation were better, if we had better bus lines going out to the suburbs, would that make a major difference in alleviating poverty?
I think it would help in that it would provide a link to where the jobs are, but it would have to run better, I think, better than the systems typically are now in terms of getting people back and forth to work in a more timely manner. And also, the practical reality of the situation is oftentimes those communities where the jobs are most likely to be created don't want public transportation to stop there. And so that then creates...
So they don't want poor people to work for them, basically.
Exactly. I remember a couple of years ago, it was such a tragic story about a woman who had a job in New Jersey. She lived in the inner city and had a job in a mall that was out in the suburbs and had to take two or three buses to get to work every day. But the closest bus to the mall, she would have to actually by foot walk across a very, very major street and ended up getting struck by a car and killed on the way to work. And so until we make it more practically possible for people to be able to get to jobs that are located a long way from where they can afford to live, it's going to make it very difficult for people to be able to pull themselves and their families out of poverty.
Now, you mentioned that people were disabled. Of course, Social Security is supposed to be not just for retirement. In fact, not even primarily for retirement. People forget that it's not a retirement program so much as it is an insurance program. It's supposed to protect you, the whole system, if you're unemployed, but also if you're disabled. Why can't the people who are disabled get the disability insurance that they've, you know, put all this money in the system after all these years? Why can't they get that money out?
That's a good question. And there are some people who do take advantage of disability insurance, but there are a lot of people who would argue that they should be able to qualify for it. But the red tape is such that it becomes very difficult for many of them. It takes many, many years to be able to qualify for that insurance. And as during that time that they're trying to prove that they are disabled, they have to make do in some way, shape, or form. We did a study here at IWPR that suggested that as many as half of the women on welfare were either themselves disabled or taking care of a disabled child, because many of them weren't having very good success in qualifying for disability insurance.
Let me ask you this. If someone has a disabled child or a disabled parent, maybe an aged parent, and is taking care of such a person, do they qualify for any federal programs, or are they out of luck?
There are theoretically programs that they can qualify for. They should be able to qualify for disability insurance. They should be able to, if they have a child, some sort of Social Security insurance to come their way. But it is a very complicated and complex thing to be able to qualify for. There are a lot of forms that you have to fill out. Oftentimes there's a lot of proof that you have to provide. And for people who, particularly if you live out in a very rural area where you have to go a long way to be able to fight your case, or if you're having literacy problems, it could be a very complex issue for you to be able to navigate on your own.
Are there advocates like yourself that go and help people? I mean, if someone were to need such help, where would they even go? I can imagine maybe the NAACP maybe does some of those things, or maybe legal aid societies. I don't even know.
I think their best bet would probably be a legal aid society. But they're definitely, I think there's a gap there. There's a gap in services. There needs to be greater outreach. Specifically, for example, once again, turning to this issue of welfare, one thing that we know, as I mentioned before, is a lot of people who end up going from welfare to work end up losing their jobs for one reason or another, and that's a whole other story. Oftentimes, those jobs just aren't very flexible, and oftentimes not even allowing one day of sick leave. So if you're late or something, you're gone. You're not given a second chance. There is some evidence that a lot of people, after they've left welfare, will qualify for other levels of assistance because the income that they're making is so low, but they haven't been connected to the right systems to be able to get them food stamps or to be able to get them child care assistance or any other form of assistance that they might need. And so we think that there needs to be a lot more proactive effort out there on the part of social services to identify these people and help them navigate the forms that they will undoubtedly need to wade through in order to make sure that they're able to get all the assistance that they indeed are entitled to.
Now, obviously, when you talk about 37 million people in poverty, you're talking about a vast number of people in all kinds of different situations, and you can't by any means tar them all with one brush. But wouldn't there be some people who are poor who really don't know how to keep a job? Maybe their parents are, you know, there could be substance abuse, someone could be in jail. They haven't really been taught the you know, what clothes to wear. They may not have those clothes, or to come to work on time. They simply don't have the job skills that someone who, you know, even lower middle class but hasn't been dirt poor knows, those basic skills, interview skills, I could imagine. Mm-hmm. Is that necessary?
I think that is part of the issue, too. There are programs out there that I'm aware of that focus on these things that they call soft skills, and that's exactly what you're talking about. Things like, you know, what do you wear to a job interview? How do you put together a resume? What do you say in terms of telephone etiquette? You know, those sorts of things. Setting your alarm clock every morning, you know, those sorts of
yeah.
things that most people take for granted. If you don't come from a community or even from a very specific household where that has not been the norm, then you don't have any sort of path to follow. Those are those social networking skills that I think most of us sort of take for granted because we grew up with that around us.
Sure, our parents know someone, our cousin, our school, maybe our teacher knows somebody. But, you know, it's sad, but the jobs in America today aren't often about who's the best qualified or who's the best at the job, but who you know. And a lot of people that live in poverty don't know the right people. Is that
and it
fair?
Becomes that much exactly, and it becomes that much more difficult when you're isolated into neighborhoods where no one really wants to go into to meet you. So the problem.
I'm wondering, and we have to go to a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about sort of breaking the back of poverty. Head Start programs have often been cited as something that's been quite successful. Maybe just getting people out of communities where. Well, there are a lot of poor people, maybe mixing them up, middle-class communities. There's so many things to talk about. If you want to join in the discussion, the toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON or 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back with more of The Inside Scoop right after this.
Harry Potter has given us all a unique glimpse at education the way it ought to be. Never once do Harry and his Hogwarts friends talk about skipping class, ducking tough instructors, waiving requirements, or shirking responsibilities. That perspective, be practical, get it the easiest, fastest, cheapest way you can, is what J.K. Rowling terms the Muggle approach to education. We're Concord University, and do we have a deal for you? At Concord, education's different than anywhere else around. There's a reason that Concord students get the best jobs, are sought out by the best medical, graduate, and law schools in the land. It's no wonder that Concord has been cited by U.S. News & World Report and by the Wall Street Journal. Where do I sign up? At Southern West Virginia's version of Track 9 and 3 Quarters. All you have to do is believe, and believe in yourself. Concord University, an education you can put to work. 1-888-384-5249.
It must have been prayer meeting with Reverend Brother Bob.
See, hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
You absolutely know that you cannot mention Robert Sunday without conjuring me. This is a known fact.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. Well, sometimes I do it on purpose.
You know, the thing that kills me, you know, God just continues to punk Robertson. after time. And it goes back for years. You know, let's just talk a bit about his business venture. From 91 to 94, he was involved in something called Calo Vita. And it was a multi-level marketing company that breeds that pyramid scheme.
Yeah, like Amway.
Sold beauty products and healthcare products. Oh, they had a product called Sea of Galilee Mud Mask.
No, they did not.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
You no.
Bob, as a heart attack, I'm serious.
Sea of Galilee Mud Mask?
Oh, yes. It was part of the product.
Prayer meeting edition of Head On with Bob Kincaid, Wednesday nights, 6 to 9 p.m. here on the Head On Radio Network.
There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder, and say, "Everything's going to be okay." That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
From Washington, more of The Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. We're talking about poverty today with Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, the Director of Poverty Education and Social Justice Programs at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. Dr. Jones DeWeaver, I wonder how many people who are poor suffer from mental conditions or substance abuse. And mental conditions, I would think, are kind of hard to prove for disability purposes. But, I mean, we used to have people go to, we call them asylums. I don't know if there's a better name for it, but institutions to help the mentally ill. And today, we're more likely to see them to wander the streets of our cities than in some safe place.
Exactly. I mean, today, with our basically shirking of our responsibilities to looking out for our most vulnerable in terms of the mentally ill, a lot of them, frankly, just end up on the streets, part of our homeless problem, which is ever-growing as well. And when you think about this issue of poverty, it's more than just the people who qualify as poor, I would argue, by these census figures, because I think you can make over $10,000 a year and be poor as a single person, you know what I'm saying, because that's the poverty line for poverty, that's the line for poverty according to the census. There are other people that are struggling right at the edges. It's been estimated that some 38 million were food insecure, meaning that they might go a day or so missing a meal because they just can't afford to buy one. It's been estimated that some 95 million people are insecure with regards to their housing, meaning that they live in poor quality housing or their housing costs so much that they have to group two, three, four families to a household to be able to afford it. So there are a lot of people struggling in our society, and a proportion of them are, as you mentioned, mentally ill or have some sort of addiction, but a lot of them are people who might have all their wits about them and just like all the rest of us, but no matter what we do in terms of working hard, just can't make enough money to keep up with the rising costs of society.
I wonder what extent that churches and synagogues and secular organizations too, but charities, Red Cross comes to mind, are helping out people. I mean, it seems to me that no one should be hungry in America. Aren't there soup kitchens to go to? Aren't there homeless shelters for people? I understand these aren't ideal situations, but at least people have a chance to get food and shelter, don't they?
Well, there are homeless shelters. That is true. The problem with most homeless shelters is that it's very difficult to find one that serves entire families. They are typically segregated by sex. And even among those who are segregated by sex, there are some that allow children, for example, mothers and children, and some that are mainly for single people, and some that are mainly just for men. So if you are a homeless family, you can't even live together anymore.
Well, that's ironic. For all this administration talks about promoting marriage, are homeless shelters... Well, let me ask, because I don't get it. I mean, churches are constantly talking about promoting families and promoting marriages. Why would churches, charities run by churches, why would they separate families? It doesn't make sense.
Well, I think part of it is, practically speaking, I think people are afraid of the possibility of some sort of abuse occurring. And so rather than to take any sort of security, extra security steps to make sure that, you know, little girls, for example, aren't assaulted, that it's just easier just to segregate by sex. But there has to be a better way, I think. I mean, not to say that they are totally non-existent. There are a few family shelters out there, but they are very, very few and far between, and definitely not enough to meet the needs, because most people are only a couple of paychecks away from homelessness themselves, whether they realize it or not. And so anyone could find themselves in the situation where ultimately they end up living out of their car just to be able to keep their families together.
Amazing. Now, of course, the president talks about faith-based organizations and all the work they're doing, and I don't doubt that there are organizations out there that are doing their best to help the poor, but their efforts aren't sufficient, are they?
Well, no, and I'm not going to chastise them for that. I think that there are a lot of charitable organizations that are doing magnificent work, but the issue, as far as I see it, is that should we shirk our responsibility in terms of a nation, what sort of social responsibility does the government have to address this issue, this national problem? Why do we need to pass the buck down to churches and down to charitable organizations that are doing the best that they can, but frankly just don't have the capacity to deal with the level of problem that we do in fact face here in America? You know,
I'd like you to go into that, because, yeah, Dr. Jones-Weaver, we're conservatives, and I have them on my program all the time, the president. They argue that the private sector does it better than the government, and the government should stay out of helping the poor and leave it to private organizations. You're saying that they just can't do enough.
They don't have the capacity. Let me give you one prime example. For example, the levees in New Orleans. That,
sure,
to me, is a governmental responsibility. Are we to say that we should just ask the Red Cross to go down there and fix it? You know, that is one of the things that we are supposedly paying for in terms of our taxes. I would much rather my tax dollars go towards making sure that a family who fell on hard times is able to stay together in their moment of crisis rather than funding another tax cut for somebody who makes more money than I will ever see. I mean, I don't really see the morality in that.
Let me ask you about the question of substance abuse. Substance abuse is something that troubles a lot of people because it's a weird combination of people who, you know, have put themselves in the place where they are and people who can't escape it. I mean, that's the weird thing about substance abuse. The first time you try it, it's your fault. The 20th time you do it, there's a physical addiction. What, if anything, can be done about the probably millions, you know the figures more than I do, but of people who are addicted to something, whether it's alcohol or crack or cocaine or something,
you know,
and that's what's making them poor. Well, what can we possibly do? I mean, I hear these treatment centers, Betty Ford or whatever, they always seem to be for the super rich,
yeah.
And very expensive too.
They are.
Not for poor people.
They are. In terms of public places where people can go that don't have a lot of money and have a substance abuse problem, they are few and far between and have waiting lists that are a mile long. You know, this issue of substance abuse is a huge one. It not only impacts and explains why a portion of our population that's in poverty remains in poverty and is unable to pull themselves out of it. It also explains a good deal of the people who find themselves behind bars in this country.
Sure.
So we really need to do something to address that on a comprehensive scale. I would argue that that needs to be part and parcel of a broader comprehensive health care package that we need to really think seriously about providing in this nation. You know,
so universal health care would solve that, come a long way into helping this problem.
I think that would need to be a key component. Substance abuse falling under the rubric of mental health care, I think, would be very, very helpful.
Toll-free numbers, 877-4-HEAD-ON. We've got Sarge on the line from Mississippi. Sarge lives in a zone affected by Katrina. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Your guest is right on. I really like what she
said. Isn't she great? I like
her
too.
She's hitting the nail on the head. And one of the things that people forget is in the most impoverished areas like Mississippi, before Katrina, we were the poorest state in the Union. Now we're just, you know, we don't even
poorer.
Have bootstraps to pull ourselves up by. And the thing that that really hurts this area, and I'm sure the guests can expand on this thought, it's the mindset that's indoctrinated into the people a lot here. It's such a caste system. You've got your haves and your have-nots here. And if you're in the have-nots, Lord help you, because you're living on like $5,000 a month, $6,000, maybe if you're lucky, $9,000 a month.
Mm-hmm. And a month or a year?
That keeps the people
a year.
Poor.
And
you mean a year, right,
the
right, Sarge?
System.
When you say $5,000, $6,000, $9,000, you mean a year, I think. You said a month.
I'm sorry, a year, yeah.
Yeah,
but
that's what I thought.
Like
what you meant.
My income, myself, you know, and I'm restricted to this. I can't make more than this. I can't even make $570 a month income.
Wow.
I mean,
because
I'm a disabled
of,
veteran.
A disabled veteran.
I've got a trust fund that I get a check off of, and then I get SSI because the VA was such a crummy organization here in Mississippi that I'd opted for SSI over an increase in veterans' benefits.
Sarge, is most of the poverty you see in Mississippi, is that rural poverty, mostly out in the countryside?
Actually, it's all over. See, now, they did a study not too long ago where they broke it down in over 220 areas, and of the 220 areas, only 13 were at or above the poverty level.
Oh. Sarge, thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. Dr. Jones-DeWeaver, I mean, Sarge illustrates that even our veterans, I mean, people who have fought for this country, risked their lives for this country, are poor.
It should be an international embarrassment. The way we treat our veterans in this nation. It is really abysmal. The fight that they have to go through to prove a lot of them that they're injured or just they're suffering. And then the constant struggle that they have to receive health care, to receive the benefits that they have due, that they are supposed to have due coming to them. It should be an international embarrassment. And in terms of the well-being of Mississippi, your call is exactly right. I've gone on several trips down to the Gulf Coast region since Katrina hit, spending a lot of time in Biloxi and Gulfport. And as devastated as New Orleans was, I think many people have kind of overlooked the devastation that was felt in Mississippi, where the eye of the storm actually came through. It actually came through Biloxi and Gulfport, not through New Orleans. I mean, those areas were absolutely obliterated. And until we really kind of think about, wow, this is going to take years and years and years and hundreds of billions of dollars, really, to let people get back on their feet, and not only just to be satisfied for making things back the way they were, because as he so aptly put, Mississippi was the poorest state in the nation. We need to look to make things better than they were, increasing wage rates, putting better jobs here so that people can get themselves out of poverty.
I have another caller on the line. It's Cassie. Cassie from Texas. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Hi. I wanted to talk about substance abuse and about that people go to jail instead of going to treatment, and then when they're in jail, they come out without... We're trying to get... My mom is in jail. Mm. For people that don't know...
For substance abuse.
Yes, I'm 15, and my mom is an addict, and she's been in jail for 3 years, 4 years, almost 4 years.
Wow.
And she wants to get on parole.
Sure.
And we're trying to get that instead of coming home on parole, that she will go to a treatment center.
And you can't afford it, I assume.
No, it has to be one that's connected to the corrections department.
Cassie, stay on the line. You raise a number of really good points, and I really appreciate your calling in, particularly at age 15. Dr. Jones-DeWeaver, I mean, here we have people who need help, like Cassie's mother, and instead of sending them to treatment facilities, we're sending them to jail. I would bet, and you're the expert, I'm not, so you tell me, I would bet treatment facilities, as expensive as they are cheaper than jail. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, in many respects they are, but the sad tragedy is, you heard her say that she's trying to get her connected through the corrections office to be able to get the treatment. The tragedy is she has a better chance of getting there through jail than she would if she were to have gone directly to treatment on herself, because it would have been very difficult for her to get past the waiting list and then to be able to pay for it. You know,
so actually, if you go to jail, and not that it's easy for Cassie's mother, because it's
no.
But if you go to jail, it's actually easier for you to get treatment than if you don't go to jail. What kind of mixed-up society do we have? I mean, that's really, really ridiculous. And as you point out, it's cheaper to be treated than to be imprisoned.
Yes.
Plus, you don't get put up with hardened criminals who, you know, I mean, substance abuse is one thing, but murder and robbery, I mean, there's a lot more severe crimes out there. Cassie, what your mom is trying to get out of she's going to be out on parole.
Yes.
The substance, do you mind telling me what it is, the substance? Is it alcohol?
Well,
is it crack?
A couple of them, but heroin was the last one.
Heroin. Now, see, heroin, I know for a fact that in Europe they have come an amazing strides in dealing with heroin. They give, I think it's methadone. I know that the heroin addiction is way down throughout Europe. Are there lessons we can learn from Europe, Dr. Jones-DeWeaver?
Yes, there is. But our problem, I think, here in this nation, instead of modeling good programs that we have seen internationally, we want to moralize things to such a degree that we're paralyzed in terms of providing some sort of action to help people. We're too busy pointing our fingers at people and chastising our people, how in the world did you let this happen in the first place, rather than facing the problem and helping people work their way out. Ultimately, you're not just helping that person. This child lost her mother effectively when she was 11. So you're helping whole families when you help parents who are themselves addicted to drugs.
Cassie, you are so brave to stay in there, to call into a radio show. I'm really a very... How are you hanging in there?
It's just I've never home during the day. But
well, I'm glad you called.
I call Bob's show all the time.
are you with your dad now? Is that
no,
crazy?
No, my brother is my guardian. He's in the military. He's a mechanic for the National Guard here in Texas.
I'm glad he's there in Texas and not sent to Iraq.
Well, he almost had to go to Iraq, but because he's my guardian and the only relative under the age of 85, he got to stay here and take care of me.
Well, Cassie, I'm so glad that you called in and shared your story with us. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Wow, God, it's funny. We talk about figures and 37 million people, and your eyes kind of glaze over. But you hear one story, just Cassie's story, and you know, there are people in worse situations than Cassie, but just her one story, I think, brings it home. You know, there are real people out there, and they're really suffering.
Definitely. And, you know, I'm the mother of a 10-year-old, so I can't imagine if a year from now, all of a sudden, I'm like, put away from him for 4 years. I mean, that's out of a child's childhood. It's a very fleeting time. 4 years out of your child's life is a long time.
What are the ages of people who are impoverished? Are there children? Are there people, they're elderly, men, women, races? Who are the poor?
Generally speaking, the majority are women and children. Specifically, if you look at those who are the poorest of the poor, those who live in dire poverty, almost two-thirds of those are, in fact, women. If you look at the raw numbers, just because of how our population is distributed, the majority in terms of the raw numbers are white Americans, but in terms of the rate or your chance of being in poverty, you're some three times more likely to be in dire poverty if you're black, and about twice as likely to be in dire poverty if you're Hispanic. So your likelihood of being impoverished is much, much higher if you are, in fact, a person of color, if you're a woman, and oftentimes if you're a child.
We haven't talked much about the Mexican population. Are the poor Hispanics in America, they tend to be born here? Are they illegal immigrants or both?
It's both, but definitely a higher proportion are those who are newly arriving groups who are just kind of getting their foothold. But, you know, the numbers in that area, I would argue, are not probably as reliable as we would like them to be. They'll probably underestimate the situation, if anything, because I'm thinking that a great deal in that population don't really want to be counted.
Sure.
So a lot of the suffering that the newly arriving groups go through, we never, ever know about.
Now, there's interesting in the Mexican-American communities, I think there's a lot of people helping people, though. There's people who arrive, and they have relatives, and they help them. And so while they're poor, they're not like, you know, Cassie, who only has her brother. They're people that have these huge networks of families.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, in the African-American community, it used to be in 30, 40 years ago, particularly in the South, the African-American church was very powerful in helping poor people. If a 15-year-old had a child, the church could find someone to take care of the child's child while that teenager went through school. Do you think the black church is not doing the same job it used to do 30, 40 years ago, or are they just overwhelmed?
Well, I think that there is a different direction in many of the black churches. I think there is somewhat of a debate going on within the black church community. There are those churches that have still conformed to the traditional sort of social responsibility tilt of the history of the black church. And then I think there is a new and emerging group of black churches that is all about, for lack of a better term, the money. I mean, frankly.
Really?
And I don't think really
that's
have
quite
those
an indictment there.
I'm sorry?
That's quite an indictment there. I mean, that's
yeah.
strong words.
I see a lot of these very, very rich, very, very prosperous churches as doing everything possible to disassociate with the least advantaged within the black community. Frankly.
Wow, so the minister's doing well, and maybe there's a beautiful stained glass window, but they're not helping the homeless in their community.
No, they're driving right past them in their Mach 5.
That's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah.
In terms of poor in America, you talked about it getting worse year by year under George Bush. What policies do you think work best, let's try to end on a happier note, to alleviate poverty? Head Start has often been praised. What do you think of Head Start, and what other programs do you think give us, you know, as policymakers, if you will, as people listening in, they're going to call their congressman, call their senator, what gives us the most bang for the buck? What helps us help the poor and help them help themselves at the least public cost, in your view?
Several things. Number one, increase the minimum wage, finally. For 10 years, okay, people have been working at a minimum wage level, and we know the cost of everything has gone up over the past 10 years. So it looks like there's going to be some movement there, but they haven't completed it yet, so make sure.
Now, the Republicans have been filibustering so they can get more tax cuts for businesses.
Exactly.
But I think it will happen, though, this year. It's just unfortunate that they're playing politics with it. Great point. What else?
Exactly. Other than that, I think a good idea is to universalize pre-K, and that kind of goes in with this Head Start. I think Head Start has been successful, but I think we need to basically expand that to every family that wants to take advantage of it. Because, as I say, there are those who might make more than is allowable to take advantage of Head Start, but still isn't really making a whole lot of money, and child care is extremely expensive. The sooner that you can get your child into a pre-K situation, the better it is for that child, and the better it is for you economically, frankly, because you're not paying those child care expenses. Also, on the other side of the spectrum, make going to college more affordable and more realistic for more people.
Good point.
The percentage of the real value, basically, of the Pell Grant has dropped tremendously over the years. For example, today the typical Pell Grant only pays about 30% of the cost of a community college tuition, only about 20 to 25% of the cost of a public college tuition, and only about 9% of the cost of private college tuition. So that's going to get you nowhere in terms of paying for a college degree. Make sure that more assistance money is put out there so that people who want to and have the ability and have the desire to go to college aren't precluded just because they don't have the money.
And that's a really important point, because I know it's changed over the last few years. My father grew up very poor, but he could, back in the 50s, he could work construction in the summers, and I think he told me he made $500 over the summer, and that was enough to afford a semester at University of Michigan.
Wow.
And he literally could get a summer job and go to a state, really, you know, a very good state
very
university.
Good school. Mm-hmm.
You can't do that anymore.
Oh, no. Oh, no. The costs have gotten astronomical. And it's particularly key, especially for women, because a woman without a college degree has a much, much higher likelihood of living in poverty, not only for the first few years, for her first few working years, but throughout her entire working years, than a man does without a college degree. So it's especially important that women and those people who are living on the edge have access to some level of post-secondary education, hopefully at least a four-year degree, so they can take advantage of this knowledge-based economy.
Do you think that when people have children too young or out of wedlock, that leads them to more of a life of poverty? And if so, what do you think are the answers? More birth control, encouraging people not to have babies so young?
Well, it definitely does. It definitely does make it more difficult to have children. The younger that you have children, you know, it's a very expensive proposition. So that does make life more difficult. No doubt about that. What we need to do is to make sure, number one, that people have opportunities. I think that is even at the basis of what's going on here. There's been some research that's been done on women who had babies at a very, very young age in very high impoverished neighborhoods. And what that research has found, that a lot of these girls aspire to motherhood because that's really the only thing they see in their neighborhoods that a girl or a woman can grow up to do and do well, is to be a mother. And so they don't see it as something that even should be put off. We need to make sure those girls know that it's possible for them to not only get out of high school, but to go into college and have a bright, bright future ahead of them before they make that life-altering decision to have a child. We also need to...
So I wonder whether more vocational programs in our schools, you know, I mean, you point out that women aren't seeing women out there in their communities. You know, I mean, there are teachers, I hope, some that are women, but certainly not enough people, you know, doctors, lawyers, police officers. Do you think that maybe more vocational education, teaching people a trade, a plumber, electrician, computer skills,
that
we need more of that?
You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
On Monday, memorial services honored the slain students and professors. Virginia Governor Tim Kaine remarked, quote, "We all suffer, we all grieve." The Johnson Space Center in Houston has been evacuated and SWAT teams are on site after reports that shots were fired there earlier today. A NASA spokesperson said a person with a weapon is inside one of the buildings. CNN reports the gunman is an employee of NASA and is armed with a handgun. A 3-mile-long wall is being built in Baghdad to separate Sunni and Shiite neighborhoods. The U.S. military is constructing the 12-foot-high barrier in the northern part of the capital city. It is expected to be finished by the end of this month. Defense Secretary Robert Gates continued his trip to Iraq.